Well, some weird things have been happening in the watery parts of the world lately. The icy parts, too. During the last week of 2015, temperatures at the North Pole peaked above freezing, some 50 degrees above the norm for this time of year. This led many in the media to observe, and scientists as well, with varying degrees of alarm in their word choices, that yes, the ice that binds our world appears to be melting. The seas are warming, and the risks for densely populated coastlines are changing big time. Billions of people live near these coastlines. The beach is pretty great, after all. River valleys are fertile, and temperatures tend to be mild. Our guest today is an educator and a scientist. His thinking is shaping the way the world prepares for sea level rise. He's penned curriculum for university students and policymakers around the world. A hydrologist and a soil scientist by training, he's got a pretty storied career across many disciplines. Today, we focus on his ideas about how to prepare for and adapt to climate change. These ideas have informed thinking across the world, something like 14 countries, including this one. The latest course he helped develop has been adopted by 62 universities across Southeast Asia, and his Arcata-based firm specializes in climate vulnerability assessment, watershed management, geomorphology, communications, and education. He worked for Research and Development Branch of the U.S. Forest Service for 33 years before retiring in 2012. He also retired from teaching at Humboldt State University a few years back. In his case, retirement is a loosely applied term. He continues to develop curriculum for land managers all over the world. He's also an independent book publisher, an advocate for natural burial, and by all accounts, a pretty cosmically keyed-in dude. Michael Furness, welcome to the show. Thanks for being our first real live guest of 2016.
Thanks very much for having me, Emily.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's a beautiful day here in the state of Jefferson. I just came back from the coast myself, spending a little of the vacation time there, and I was thinking about this discussion, really how we even conceptualize sea level rise. I'm hoping maybe we could start there, the different ways of thinking about it.
Well, it's when we look at how to adapt or what this is going to mean for us, it's important to understand how sea level changes on the Earth and how it works. Basically, we had an unusual 6,000 years of stability. The last 6,000 years, we've had basically stable sea level. This is unusual. Usually, the sea level on the Earth is either rising or falling very rapidly. And in these interglacial periods, we seem to have kind of a slack tide period where we have a stable sea level for several thousand years. And that's where we've been. That's where civilization developed. That's what we're used to. That also means we've had a stable, moderate climate. And that appears to be over. So we've had about 8 inches of sea level rise since the early 1900s. Because of the rapid warming that humans are creating, we can expect that to continue for centuries and perhaps millennia, even regardless of what we do in the future. A lot of sea level rise is already cooked in to the climate system. And the reason it changes so fast is because of the ice ages and the interglacials. Basically, I think most everyone is familiar with that. But over the last 2.5 million years, these immense continental ice sheets have advanced and retreated dozens of times. And each time they advance, the amount of Earth's water bound up in ice sheets increases and sea level drops. And with each retreat of the ice sheets, the meltwater is released and sea level rises. And during that time, the level of the world's oceans fluctuate over a range of about 500 feet.
So how, in this common age, you're talking about the anthropogenic changes or anthropogenic causes driving this, how is this different from the kind of age-old melting and then contraction of the world's ice sheets, continental ice sheets?
Well, basically the Earth is capable of very rapid sea level change, and we can see that in the paleo record, that sea level can change quite quickly. We actually should be going into a period now where it's getting colder. So we understand why the ice ages happen. It's because of orbital variations, and that increase the tendency of the Earth to accumulate ice. And there's some feedbacks that amplify that system. And those orbital changes, which, you know, are well understood now, should be driving us colder. And instead, we see a warming, distinct and very rapid warming trend. And this is sort of canceling the next ice age. Now, that the next ice age would be 50,000 years off, so it's a very slow process. But we're instead of cooling, as the natural variations would have us do at this point, we're warming very rapidly. And the ocean is basically like a big thermometer. And reflects the amount of heat in the total climate system. And as it gets warmer, those ice sheets melt and the ocean actually expands because of the thermal effect. The warmer water takes up more space.
So you mentioned that the oceans, the sea level, has changed by 8 inches since the early 1900s. We hear about centimeters changing at the local level after events or perhaps an earthquake can do the job much quicker. All in all, it doesn't sound that dramatic, 8 inches in 100 years. You've traveled a lot. Where have you seen what this really looks like and how a matter of inches can be so transforming?
Yeah, well, 8 inches doesn't sound like much, but if you live really close to the coast, chances are very good that you've already noticed this. And it's been noticed all around the world. For example, in Miami, the sewers, instead of draining water out to the sea, they're bringing water in to the street at high tide. Sea level is a vertical change, and most coastlines are largely horizontal. So in many places, if you have, say, a foot of sea level rise, you have about 300 feet of landward incursion of the ocean into the land. On the north coast here, we're kind of mountainous and kind of jacked up by tectonic forces, and so that limits our vulnerability, except for areas where we have estuaries and large coastal plains, for example, like Humboldt Bay or San Francisco Bay, that are quite gentle and vulnerable. But there are a number of other places in the world, including the eastern and south and southern part of the U.S., that are very gentle and very close to sea level, but the real hot spots of the world are the mega deltas, like the Mississippi or the Mekong or the Nile Delta, are these very large deltas that have just developed in that stable sea level period of 6,000 years. That's how old they are. And most of them are just full of people. Lots and lots of people live there because there's lots of protein, there's navigation, there's recreation, and moderate climate, and these areas are all very, very susceptible. So a meter of sea level rise, for example, creates a huge, huge problem in the Mekong Delta for Vietnam or in the Nile Delta for Egypt. And, of course, the Mississippi Delta is already in deep, deep trouble, but if you add another we've already added some, but if you add more sea level rise there, the problems are amplified greatly. So,
you just mentioned how these areas, which we think of as some of the most fertile, populated places on Earth, the Mississippi Delta, the Mekong, the Nile, use the word vulnerable just now to describe them. What do you mean when you talk about something as big as the Nile Delta being vulnerable?
Well, vulnerability is a combination of the exposure to a change and then how sensitive it is to that change. The sensitivity means there's things there that are valued or valuable or things that we care about or things that are important to ecosystem function. So say we go up to the Mackenzie Delta in northern Alaska. You know, there are a few people that live there, but not many, very few. And they have places they can retreat to. And if sea level rises and that gets inundated there, you actually probably have better salmon habitat, and there's no infrastructure in the way to block the migration of biologicals. probably not very vulnerable because of the situation there. But if you have millions of people in the way, or say you have Alexandria in the way or New Orleans in the way, then that exposure to sea level rise comes to a very sensitive situation, and there's a lot of loss and a lot at stake and a lot to be lost. So that's what vulnerability means in this context.
Right. And I wanted to ask you, it's totally a hometown question, but the first place I ever laid eyes on the sea is Galveston, Texas, and they're dealing with their own issues, too. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So what you really need to know when you look at a particular place and its vulnerability is not just what the global and regional sea levels might do, but what mm-hmm. the local sea level will, how that will manifest. And that depends not just on the level of the water, but the level of the land. And land levels in most places are not stable. They're not static. They change. For example, here on the North Coast, we have places that are going down and places that are going up as the plates kind of grind against each other. And then everything changes when we have an earthquake and other places go down and other places go up. Galveston is an interesting example because it's sinking, and it's sinking very rapidly. And we find this effect also in many other areas. For example, the Mekong or the Nile or Bangkok in Thailand are sinking rapidly. And this is mainly due to the extraction of groundwater. So when you take the groundwater out, that's basically holding the land up, and it causes the overall land level to sink. And this causes the relative sea level or the local sea level to rise. So even if you have stable sea level, you have an effect of rising local sea level as they've been dealing with in Galveston and putting up giant seawalls and whatnot to protect the city because of that land subsidence or that land sinking effect. Also, the weight of the infrastructure. This is a big deal in Bangkok, which is a real mega city. And the actual weight of the buildings and the freeways and everything is actually pushing the landscape down and effectively rising, raising the local sea level.
Oh, wow. We're talking this morning with Michael Furness. He's a hydrologist, soil scientist, and a longtime educator about watershed management. And today we're talking about how to prepare for climate change and sea level rise. You are welcome to join this discussion with Michael. Phone number 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about what vulnerability means in these low-lying areas that are going to be the first susceptible to sea rise, already seeing it. There's another word that comes up a lot in the materials you've developed, Michael, and that word is resilience. Could you talk about what is resilience when we talk about an ecosystem or a landscape?
Well, in formal ecology, resilience means the ability of a system to bounce back to its former state after a disturbance. But that word has come to mean a combination of resilience and resistance in the ecological nomenclature. And that is, you can resist changes in the first place, or if those changes happen, then you can kind of roll with it or bounce back. And really, it's the flip side of vulnerability. So if you're resilient, you're not vulnerable. If you're vulnerable, you're not resilient. And so what we're after is resilience. We want places and populations and people and ecosystems to be able to resist and bounce back from these kinds of disturbances. But it turns out that resilience is hard to discern. It's mm-hmm. more difficult to say this is resilient and this isn't. But vulnerability is easier to discern. And so that's what we look for, and that's why you'll see vulnerability assessments. You don't see resilience assessments, but they really are resilience assessments. We're looking for vulnerabilities, and if you're vulnerable, you have a resilience challenge. And if you're not vulnerable, then you're already resilient. And this is really the first step in adapting, is to figure out and make these distinctions of what's vulnerable and what isn't, what's resilient and what isn't.
We still on that first step when it comes to this kind of work, climate change, vulnerability assessment, and planning to adapt communities? Have any of your theories been tested yet?
Well, we are on that first step. And there's been a fairly detailed vulnerability assessment, for example, conducted for Humboldt Bay. It's ongoing. There's more work to do, more detailed work, but we basically have a pretty good picture of what can be lost. And that basically goes on the table, and then we can take a look at that and collaborate and plan and figure out what we're going to do about it. And there's lots of options. San Francisco Bay has a fair amount of vulnerability assessment. The U.S. Geological Survey and NOAA and others have been quite focused on the eastern and southern U.S., which is much more vulnerable because of the coastal slope is much less than on the west coast. And so those vulnerability assessments are kind of coming in. And once you know that, then you can start to scratch your head and put this in front of planners and property owners and everyone else and say, okay, what are we going to do about this?
In the developing this curriculum, I think I mentioned in your introduction, the product for Southeast Asia, say, is now in something like 62 universities with 7 countries using it. Do you have to change the curriculum for assessing vulnerability significantly depending on the geography of the region? I mean, for example, you were a senior science advisor on a project in Ecuador about climate vulnerability. Did the takeaways there apply to someplace like Humboldt Bay, or is every place facing pretty unique challenges?
Yeah, the basics of it are generalized and apply everywhere. So that's nice. It's not always the same situation with ecosystems and forest types and even communities. But with sea level rise, it's a relatively discrete problem, actually.
How do you mean discrete problem?
Well, you can define the area of inundation. For example, the tsunami hazard maps, and I think probably everyone that's driven on the coast sees these signs. It's like entering tsunami hazard area. Well, those tsunami hazard areas are basically the same as the sea level rise vulnerable areas. There's some nuance to that, actually, though, because of flooding and particular episodic events where you have very high tides and storm surge and maybe flooding of freshwater coming the other way, and the water inundation zone will actually be considerably larger than just what the basic sea level rise would do. But basically, it is a generalized kind of phenomenon and one that we can figure out. I also work in forestry and forest vulnerability, and everybody wants to know which forest types are going to disappear and where they're going to move to, and it turns out to be a much more difficult problem. We don't know what these organisms need and where they can live, but sea level rise is a little more discrete in that way. It's a definable problem, and we can pretty much say here's the vulnerable areas, and here's the areas that are going to have the most problem, where you're going to have to deal with it, or you're going to have to move. That people always want to know what's going to happen locally, and that requires a detailed assessment and an understanding of how the ground elevation is changing, which we do have here now in Humboldt County, but a lot of places don't have that yet.
So Humboldt County is sinking, but then the land north of it is rising. Do I have that straight?
That's right, yeah. The southern part of Humboldt Bay is sinking, and so relative sea level is rising. And then to the north, say when you get to Arcata and then all the way up to Crescent City, it's rising. And so it's sort of getting out of the way of sea level rise. And in some places, it may be, in fact, just outrunning sea level rise.
Right. So people, in that case, a form of resilience would be just moving kind of accepting that the water is going to take a different course. And as you mentioned, in Alaska, maybe it'll actually be better for some of the natural resources in the area.
That's right. One of the first, there's three basic categories of adaptation. One is retreat, where you move. Another is accommodate, where you put your house on stilts or pontoons or live in a boat. And the third is resist. And you can resist if you're wealthy, like the Dutch have done, or you have a situation where you actually can put up a wall and hold the ocean out. For example, southern Florida can't do that because the rocks are porous there. They're limestone, and the ocean will go, the water will go right under the wall. But anyway, so there's a lot of different options that one can look at. But overall, I think, especially in the developing areas, you basically need to look at where people might be able to live in the future as the ocean kind of reclaims these areas of land.
And kind of quickly here, you talked about rapidly sinking as parts of Humboldt Bay are versus a rapid rise to the north. You're a geologist, so I'm a little skeptical of what you mean by rapid. What's the time scale? You know, assuming that we're not looking at an episodic or a cataclysmic event that suddenly rises sea level, what is the time scale stepping out of the 6,000-year period of relative calm?
Yeah, rapid to a geologist would be the speed like at which a fingernail grows.
That's pretty fast. That's pretty fast.
It's pretty fast, but some people would think that's slow. But, you know, you have to take a broad perspective in geology. And the magnitude of land level changes kind of matches the magnitude of sea level change in many areas. So you're talking about 2 to 5 millimeters per year of uplift or subsidence, and also that same kind of rate of sea level rise, although that could accelerate in the near future.
Well, some thoughts about humility before nature this morning with Michael Furness, talking about sea level rise and some of our options: retreat, accommodate, or resist. Michael, thanks so much for being on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Emily.